cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the business section of our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the finance team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio today is Safia Boulay of New Habits, Making Shift Happen.
Looking forward to an awesome show, Richard.
Thank you. Also joining us in studio as part of our panel is Cynthia Schumann of the Ethics Monitor. Welcome, Cynthia.
Pleasure to be here.
Our guest today is Belinda Dovestone of the Sadar Group. Belinda, thank you for joining us on the line from Cape Town.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. So, Belinda, the reason we're chatting to you is that wonderful question of ethics and the board. We've been talking about the launch, and we've just launched in the previous show our focus on ethics in business and in the community and in public life. And we're going to be doing that on a monthly basis. We're having an ethics focused show. But I guess one of the starting points is this whole question of ethics within the company environment. Now, as a member of the Sadar Group, and we have had Carl Bates, your founder of Sadar, on the show with us historically, we know a little about the Sadar Group and what you do around the world of boards. But perhaps if I could ask you to just share with our listeners, for those that haven't had the privilege of listening to Carl, just a quick synopsis of what Sadar does and what Sadar is about.
Fantastic. Thanks, Richard. We really focus on implementing boards in the private company and family business space. We know a lot about boards in the public company space, yet private companies are where all the action is at, and where the future big companies emerge from. That's where we really focus, and we focus on educating and guiding boards, putting boards in place, and really creating a high-performance board that is focused on growing companies, not just ticking off checklists, which we typically think boards are all about.
Interestingly, in the previous show, we had the discussion about whether compliance is the checklist or not. So once again, here comes the checklist, everyone. So Belinda, I mean, obviously, just perhaps an opportunity for you to give us some initial comments and thoughts. I mean, the whole question of ethics and governance, I think, you know, people often use the terms not interchangeably often. They'll obviously sometimes stipulate to one or the other. And for me, ethics and governance are just words on the same, two different sides on the same coin. It's all about how you behave in a corporate, and in this case, we're referring to specifically the corporate space. What is your view, and what is the Sadar view on that? This whole question of ethics and governance, and kind of let's just put a stake in the ground in terms of where do you see this in your world?
Well, there's a couple of different dimensions. Now, in my simple language, you know, ethics is really about doing the right thing, and of course, the question is, what does that actually mean? What is the right thing? And so, we tend to find that in private company boards, one of the great challenges of answering this question of doing the right thing is the question around the founder of the business, who might be the major shareholder, usually is the chief executive of the business, who is in that space, holding that space as a leadership role, yet is very conflicted around what doing the right thing might mean. And that's typically because that person wears three hats. They wear the hat of shareholder, of director, and of manager. And when you are sitting around the boardroom table wearing the director hat, you may not wear your shareholder hat. Yet, very often we see in private companies, decisions are made that are massively significant in terms of how they impact stakeholders. And those decisions are made from a selfish point of view. So we hold this view that a position of a director is quite a position of selfless service, where you have to make decisions that are in the best interests of the company. That's what, you know, the Companies Act requires of us as directors, but you also might be conflicted in that decision negates your personal wealth on some level if you are a shareholder. So we often see this main conflict around doing the right thing emerging when there's a conflict between the shareholder hat and the director hat. And really, I mean, our Companies Act is incredibly visionary, some would say quite radical, in how it expects us as directors, whether you're a tiny little company and your name's on the piece of paper, whether you're a huge company, to act in a particular way, and that is act in the best interest of the company first and foremost. So when we receive cash payment from a client, And we look at that cash in our hand and think, gee, it'll be a nice weekend city. You know, this is what happens in businesses in our country, smaller businesses in particular. So how do we do the right thing in a way that we act in the best interest of the company and put our own selfish interests ahead, or behind rather, what the company, this child that we are responsible for? And so when you have a board that has independent directors, it becomes easier to call the game and to see that that's happening, and to really keep on putting the life and well-being of this child ahead of our own personal interests, if that analogy makes sense.
Yeah, I must say, by the way, I like your use of analogy of the child, because unfortunately a business is often like a child. It needs instruction. It needs guidance. It goes through different stages of growing. So, you know, teenager, you know, starts as a child, nurturing, the nurturing process, etc. And the interesting thing about a child is occasionally you do have the temper tantrum moment where the child and the parents are not necessarily in sync.
Occasionally.
And what the boundaries are. Yes, don't look at me like that. Yeah. You and I both have children. We know what we're doing with. But yeah, I like your analogy there, Belinda.
So it really is. It's quite an interesting journey to watch that struggle, the psychological battle, where you started the business when it was, you know, you were a founder, and it was all about getting more for your own wealth, you know, doing something for you, and you get to this point where it's not about you anymore, and the psychology of that shift from it's about the baby, the child, and actually I'm just an instrument of its growth is quite a huge psychological journey that we see directors go through.
Mm. No, Cynthia, I mean, you've been sitting here quietly listening to Belinda.
Yeah. Clearly chomping at the bit.
So give us some insights on what Belinda's talked about there and what you've observed in this world.
I think the inherent conflict of interest that Belinda is raising between wearing those multiple hats is absolutely real. And for me, I'm not saying this can be avoided easily, but I often find that ethics is not nearly an area that is as well understood in depth as is necessary by the leadership wearing those various hats. Mm. So I look at it and I would put it to the organization, if we posed a simple question in terms of any of those hats, is ethics important? We've all got it that yes is the right answer. I've got the what's in it for me in personal wealth, but I mean, now we're assuming we're not dealing with outright scoundrels. We're dealing with people who are generally, you know, trying to build some assets, and this is all perfectly acceptable. But where ethics is not incorporated into the financial and the strategic long-term goals of the organization, where we're not according ethics a recognized value, we exacerbate this risk of the conflict of interest of, is it in my best interest, the company's best interest, or whatever the other parties may be.
Mm. The one thing that strikes me, Belinda, as you talk about the conflict of interest and the likes. I mean, I think we often think of the director, the owner, the manager, and the different roles in the business. But as a professional board member in a family owned and privately owned company, there must be some challenges that your directors see and experience. How do they go about educating that business owner and kind of having these, I guess you could call them ethical conversations, because there are a whole lot of other conversations that potentially play out. But how do they go about doing that? I mean, what is your, how do you deal with that?
I think there's multi facets to that question. It's a great question. I think the most powerful thing we can do is to be absolutely conscious of the power of language, of the words we use. And so I'll call you on the term business owner.
Okay.
But when we were working through and writing and finishing off Carl Bate's book, Traversing the Avalanche, we asked Professor Mervyn King to write a foreword for the book. And he read the book and in true gentlemanly style said, thank you for the offer, but I decline unless you change some key parts of your book. And, of course, we were horrified. And, of course, ethical leadership is a key part of King 3 and 4. And so he said, this thing, business owner, this is all wrong. He says, this actually doesn't exist. It's a thing that doesn't exist. And language is important. So while we continue to use the word business owner, we perpetuate this idea that there is an ownership or rights over the asset, which you don't actually have as a shareholder.
Mm.
So one of the things around language is getting right in the boardroom and understanding of what these things mean. So we ban the word business owner in our boardroom. So you're a shareholder manager.
You're a shareholder manager. Okay.
You're a shareholder manager. You're a shareholder who happens to be a manager who's sitting in the director chair. And so this language thing is really important because the more we use the word, I own a business, no, you run a business that you have shares in. It's like getting around the way we think and changing the way we think around the distinction between me and the business or the entity. Mm. That's the language is a key part of it. A second part of it is establishing a clear set of values for the board to be guided by. So really upfront, it's really critical that the board works out what are the values that it holds itself accountable to, sets that in a charter, and then goes about, you know, holding itself accountable to living up to those values. So you take then the values away from the individuals around the table and create a value for the board, which should obviously be a key part of the values of the organization. And really it is about having that conversation and being able to hold each other accountable to a new way of thinking, creating this very strong language. And by that, you can really unlock it. So, for example, one of our clients had this process of actually wearing the three hats or having the three hats as literally hats with a label, shareholder, director, and manager at each of three hats. And they would sit wearing their director hat in the meeting because it's about keeping your mind in the right place and making decisions, the right decisions from the right place in that moment.
The thing, though, Belinda, is, and I mean, this is a fascinating conversation in the sense that we are designed to self-preserve. We are designed to check out what is good for us. How do you go about? I mean, what is the practical things that you do with your directors to help them to step into that role of selflessness and becoming clear about their responsibilities to the company and the people who will exist far beyond the founder? I'm thinking of a Greek saying that says, wise men plant trees for even though they will never sit and benefit from its shade, something like that.
Yeah.
And how do you get through that process? Because it's almost counter to the way in which we are designed.
Very much. I think it's about giving the selfish interest, if I may call it that, a job to do. So the place where the selfish interest plays off is, in fact, and I say selfish in a positive way, not in a bad way.
Yeah.
So where it plays a role is in the shareholder hat,
okay,
where you put an investment into a business and you're expecting a return. The business can't guarantee you return because it might be acting out of its own best interest. But that's the place for the selfish interest. But the hat has a place and a time. So I think by having really good directors around the boardroom table and having independent directors, no matter where you might find them, having quality independent directors helps you to leave that shareholder hat out that board meeting. Focus on doing and being the best directors you can be as a unit, as a collective, and then finding ways of dealing with the shareholder hat in the right way. So we had an example, and this is one of the classic examples of where that this overriding ethical conflict comes in, is typically that businesses are started, founded, and run from a premises that the shareholders have bought. That the shareholder property, we have running the business from the property, and then we're obviously renting it out to the business. Sometimes at a terrible premium. I mean, that's what happens. And so when you sit around the boardroom table and you've got a debate whether or not you terminate your lease as a company, but it's your building that you're earning rent from, it's a little tricky. And so you start to see in those moments the quality of the ethical leadership. And that's when the independent directors say, right, if you're conflicted in this decision, like best you leave the boardroom because the independent directors are going to make a decision. And so it's about working the process in the right way and being absolutely conscious of the real conversation that's happening around the boardroom. What you're really talking about is emotional intelligence at the end.
But Richard, I think that introduces the point you made around ethical conversations. Mm. You know, at that level, we wouldn't call it ethical training. But I think ethical conversations around grappling with real dilemmas, such as Belinda has just described, I don't think that this is automatic. I don't think that this is necessarily where we have a depth of knowledge or experience. Mm. And that's where I believe there can be huge value in having those ethical conversations. Mm. The other area is speaking to the point of, I would almost put it under the banner of what's in it for me. Now, I appreciate in terms of those different hats, there apparently would be a different answer. But I think we're not exploring that well enough. If we're looking at the fact that these businesses are intending for longer term growth, then let's have a conversation about the brand and the company reputation. And I would take it so far as to saying, if we're looking at the what's in it for me question, yes, we've got the shareholders, yes, we've got the directors. If you were to ask your employees, and it's an extraordinarily powerful exercise, why would you personally, as an employee, want to work for an ethical organization? I'm not going to take you through the details of the exercise. We can do that on another show. But actually, the answers, again, are in the positive. Employees even can answer what's in it for me to be part of an ethical organization. So I think the ethical conversations can address those dilemmas, not after they happen, but equip boards, equip directors to have applied their mindset in advance, but also to enable them to explore, seeking out the commonalities in what's in it for me to be ethical, because the answers actually are fabulous.
Hmm. I think if I, and Belinda, I mean, to your point of, you know, in your example, and I'll go back to that, your example of the property owned scenario and the concept of, you know, I step out of the conversation. I must say, I've often observed scenarios where I'm sitting in a meeting where a matter of conflict of interest is very clear and apparent, and I'm often amazed at how people react when they get asked to leave a meeting where a conflict of interest is apparent. And I'm also quite interested to watch people's reactions when I've excused myself from a meeting because of a conflict of interest and say, look, I'm, you know, a connected party with this provider, or whatever. I've given you the information that you need. I'm going to step out of the room so that you can make a decision. And when I did this, people were almost taken aback that you would do something like that. It's almost like, you know, it's almost, I guess, not the norm, it would appear. I mean, is that something that you encourage, Sadar, that you drive into that director conversational space, that whole principle of managing conflicts of interests actively and engagingly?
Very much so. And I mean, I'm sure that people in the room have still not forgotten the moment you got up and walked out, because it is such an unusual thing to see, this idea of conflict and how do you manage it. And, you know, I think there's a number of things, you know, we could talk for hours about the challenge of ego and what's mine is mine and my power and control and all those lovely things that happen. Mm. And I think that, so one of the facets is that really from a legal point of view, from a compliance point of view, we talk about not compliance in terms of checklists, but what we are required and expected to do is to act in the example the way that you've indicated, is to declare your interest, declare conflict, manage the conflict, and allow the best decision to happen. I mean, that's a legal requirement. Mm. I think the big challenge is that people don't really understand just what a big problem that is in not doing it. Mm. And so there's an ethical, social, moral element to that, and there's a legal element to it. And I think it's learning how to make great conscious decisions. That is a big learning journey. We're talking about this learning of the ethical training. that ethical training happens in every single decision we make when we ask ourselves, do we put the interests of the company first, and do we make decisions from the right place? Because the legal framework says we don't really worry too much that the outcome of a decision was right or wrong. What we're interested in is the process you went through. What was the way that you thought about the problem? What was the guidance system you used to make a decision, and where was your ethical leadership framework in that? Mm. And that's a very interesting place for us to learn and grow through.
Well, I think you raise, and you've used a term there that I think we're going to kind of pick on and perhaps develop in some future shows, the whole concept of the ethical leadership framework. I mean, you know, how that defines, and I guess that could have some different words. You could put values as part of that. I'm not sure. I'm looking at my experts in the room. but I think, you know, for me, the framework of how you measure, for me, at the ethical space actually becomes the key point, because effectively, I think ethics is fundamentally the questions of what is acceptable and what is not, and what is done and what is not done. And so if your framework is a little bit out of kilter, you know, what's wrong for me may not be wrong for you. And so you have to almost, there has to be an accepted, let's call it the norm of what the ethical framework looks like. So that, you know, we can all define what look, you know, how we refer. I'm constantly reminded. I saw a picture, and it was intended to be humorous, but it really made me stop and reflect. It was a picture of a number of world leaders on a page. And I won't say which leaders were on there, but I don't want to insult anyone, but I can tell you that it was covered with images of leaders that find themselves at the negative side of countries and comments and the press and the likes. And this page was headed up. It said there's 2.7 billion people in the world. And this is the best we could come up for leadership. best we could. And I looked at this and I thought, okay, well, that's a function of the frameworks of reference. And then I thought to myself, well, hold on a second. Let's do this picture for our business.
Yes.
Here's the leaders in our business put out on the page. And I guess in your case, we could put the directors of the board. You know, we go to the annual report and take all those lovely little square pictures of the board. And we put them out there and we say, we have 100 people in the business. And here are the leaders. Is this the best we could come up with? And if the answer is no, oops.
Yeah, big problem.
Big problem. I mean, I guess, and Melinda, I mean, things like, let's call it board evaluation and effectiveness evaluations. I know that's part of what you do as part of the board process. Does ethics play in that world as well? Is it part of the conversation or not?
Absolutely. I mean, a board at an absolute minimum should be, you know, formally once a year reviewing its performance. An ethical leadership framework, our values, our ability to live our company values in every decision is a key part of that annual evaluation. So on one hand, that's a critical process, and we do see that some companies, even though you might have a process to capture that, there's still an avoidance of dealing with the elephant in the room, which is a culture issue of not actually being absolutely authentic and open and direct around where the challenges are. So we still see that coming through the board evaluation, where you've got this behavior of the board of all being too nice, even when they should be quite direct and open about really important things, the big elephants. Mm. And part of that process is putting that back into the loop and saying, well, next year, let's just focus on being better at dealing with conflict or dealing with the elephants. So there's an annual process, but, you know, a year to wait for changes to happen is far too long, especially in a private company environment. So our view is that at the end of every meeting, a high-performance director should ask themselves one question. How could I have added more value to that board meeting? And second of all, why didn't I?
Hmm.
And so the key thing is being absolutely and exceptionally critical of our performance as a director, whether you are the founder or you're an independent director or non-executive, whatever your place in the sun might be, that we're exceptionally critical of our performance as a director. And I think creating that culture at a director level is going to shift the ethical outcomes we're seeing.
Belinda, can I ask you to repeat those two questions again for me?
So how could I have added more value to that board meeting, and why didn't I?
Wow. Now that's cool. What Sophia and I would call an honest conversation with oneself.
Yes. And I would add, from an ethical point of view, that great questions, but if ethics is not part of the value proposition, if the reflection of value and success is only financial, can we please accept we're going to get a skewed answer?
Yeah.
It might not be a wrong answer, but it will be a skewed answer. And again, I feel like ethics is not being brought in as a measure of value.
Yeah. I think and I think that's something that we're going to focus on as we go through the series, is people don't understand how to measure and value ethics at a level in any organization. If you were to say to the CEO or the CFO, so what is the value of ethical behavior? They might, I often refer to it as the orange jumpsuit equation. You know, am I doing something that's going to end up with my executives in an orange jumpsuit, you know, orange is the new black, at the local cells? But, you know, ethics goes far beyond that. It's not just about who gets arrested for stuff and if it goes all that way. It's about your reputation. It's about your brand. It's about your reputation with your employees. I mean, yes. You know, that's one interesting thing. And Belinda, maybe in closing, I can ask you to comment on this. But one of the things that I've observed is you can actually tell a lot about a company and its board. And particularly when things change within a company and board structures and management, etc., by watching the movement of the people in the layers below. So, you know, you're changing an executive or you change board composition or something, and then suddenly you see this massive exodus of people that have been very comfortably in the organization, and you kind of then go, okay, if they're making the decision to leave, what's the conflict that's arisen? And I often ask myself the question, you know, do people have the guts to say, hey, my new leader isn't ethical and I'm not going to stick around to wait for the consequences of that and I'm going somewhere else? And my personal experience tells me that actually does happen, and people do make that strong decision to take that exit point. So yeah, that's something we're going to need to think about into future shows. Linda, just final comments from your side. I mean, anything kind of, let's call it the one pearl of wisdom that you'd like to leave with us around ethics and board interaction, something that you haven't perhaps shared with us so far?
Absolutely. I'll share a very short story. I was at a talk recently, and I listened to a CEO of a large South African company based in Cape Town. And the CEO was in final interview stages with the company and was being flown in from Johannesburg for the interviews. And on both occasions, he was driven to the office by a particular driver, the same driver both times. And, you know, the CEO, as part of his interview process, has asked the directors lots of questions about the values of the organization, what it stands for, and its ethical framework. And so he asked this driver, he said, tell me about what working for this company means to you. And he said, the driver said the same thing that the directors were saying. And he said, that's a company that I will work for, a company that right through the organization, there's line of sight from the directors right to the driver of the ethics of the organization, who we are and what we stand for. And it was the driver that convinced him to sign the piece of paper. And I think we underestimate how important it is that it's not just about the ethical discussions that happen at board, but how that conversation, how that mindset is carried through the entire organization. That's what's important.
Belinda, that's an incredible insight. That's Belinda Dovestone of the Sadar Group. Thank you very much for your time and contribution to the show. We really do appreciate it. To my fellow panelists, thank you very much for your time. Next up, the Youth Leadership Platform. CliffCentral.com.